Welcome to Planetary Tantra Talk number 8 on Grok the Talk. The date here is June the 28th, 2011. We're in the last couple days of the Idris shift, looking forward to a new moon here in a couple of days. And in this eighth installment, we are going to be kind of tying up some loose ends and preparing for the next phase, you could say, of the post-correction that took place on March 19, which we'll be talking about a bit more at the beginning here. And let's see, I have a couple things to announce. We will have two versions of the Fall of the Wisdom Goddess narration done in feminine voices, which are very professionally read. And another woman has recorded a version of the Gaian Mythos, the Fallen Goddess scenario. And that will be up very shortly as well. And by the time this is on up and going on the internet, we will have a recording video as well. Let's see, I think that's all I have to announce. And John, I welcome you to the Planetary Tantra Talk number 8. And if you have anything you'd like to say at the outset, please go ahead and go with that.
Thanks, Thomas. It's good to be back with you. Excuse me if I sound a little stuffy, but I seem to catch things sometimes when I ride on airplanes. It takes me a few days to shake them out of my system. I just want to say that I'm happy and pleased and grateful to have these female readings of the Fallen Goddess scenario. And it's wonderful for me to know that that material is out there and being presented in a woman's voice, in the voice of several women, and in yours as well. You were the first one to record it, and that's also of equal value. So it's good for the story that the story is getting out in that manner.
Yes, and I'm getting from these two women that did their recordings, they both reported back saying that going through the process of doing the narration, you know, you can't do it in one take. It takes you, you know, a few, five, six times to get it correct. And by reading this and being so familiar with it, it really gets in there and starts to resolve questions you've had and kind of focus your life energy in a proper direction, in a sense. So it's something, you know, you could do as a hobby or as an experiment at home as well. Go ahead and, you know, vocally read the Fall of the Wisdom Goddess.
I think so. It's clear to me, and I've said this a number of times in interviews and in my writings, that there is no other myth known to our species comparable to this myth. That's not an overstatement. And yet, it may not be so easy to get your mind around that statement. It may not be so easy to realize the impact of that fact if you just think about it. But if you get involved with the story, if you read it over and over again, or if, as you say, you read it aloud as a kind of recitation, you may find that it's installing itself into your neuro-linguistic circuits in a particular manner. As I said, I'm starting to write these post-correction pieces now. And as I said in the introduction to the post-correction material, this story is unique because it is the only narrative that will root your NLP to source, because it is a story about source. So everyone wants to know about source. Everyone wants to know, you know, about God and creation and how we got here and how the earth came to exist and where humanity came from. And this is a story that answers those questions in a way that no other story does, and answers a great many other questions as well. So when I say that this is a story about source that roots your NLP to source, I'm proposing something that you can test and find that out for yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy to hear you say that that these readers, the readings and recitations, are immediately verifying this the unique and powerful animating nature of this story.
Yeah, I that really was my experience doing that a few months ago, and to hear that from other people as well, it's a kind of a reinforcement that I'm not unique in that case. And I must say that it has resolved some dilemmas or some questions that I've had since, you know, I was a very young boy, you know, around 10 years old. And the one thing that it really resolved for me, and I won't go into it now, but was the question of death. That was the one thing that always was on my mind. And this the story has just completely erased the fear of death, for one thing, and put it into a proper context. And I think that's something that people who are familiar with the story already will probably be able to figure out in what way that resolves that problem.
Sure. Yeah, well, as you know, and as some of those listening will know, if they're familiar with this material, that the Sophianic vision story contains answers and truths about fundamental aspects, fundamental riddles of human existence that are not found in any other myths, and certainly not found in a lucid and coherent form in any other myths. So the power of it is something that we're going to be discovering now by using it, by applying it.
Mm-hmm.
The secret of creative mythology that Joseph Campbell signaled to, he signaled and pointed to it. He didn't actually practice it himself. Now we can practice creative mythology. And the key to creative mythology is that you do not use myth merely to interpret experience, but it becomes a directing power in your experience.
Yeah, and that's a big difference. And you have spelled that out so well for us with your 35, 40 years of work on this, that it's very exciting now that we can actually get our hands dirty and kind of dig in. It's a very exciting time.
Yeah, it sure is. So what do we need to do, Tom? So we're going to review a little bit here and take a look at what some of the key issues we've touched in the last 7 talks, or do you have some high points or questions you want to raise before we look ahead to what's coming?
Yes, what I have here is, well, I've got mountains of notes that I've kind of filtered through, and there's just a few questions that I want to run by you tonight. I hope I can get through much of them, and we can kind of round things up at the end there with a look ahead to what's coming in the post-correction talks. So let's go ahead and just start jumping into these. Let's do these as briefly as we can. I mentioned last time in our talk that for me to resolve or to work with these energies that you become familiar with when you connect into the Shakti cluster. In my case, working with Aikido has been the best avenue to prepare the body and to work and kind of make the mind and the body into a vessel that can handle these things. Now, if this is not too personal, John, I would love to hear if you have any preferences for how you have worked with these energies over the years.
No, I haven't followed any particular martial arts discipline. I often wish that I had. Didn't have the right occasion or the circumstances to pursue it through my life. It was often something that was there, but somehow didn't make itself within my reach. Basically, I have been using telestic shamanism, or the practices of cording, and the practice of deep immersion in nature with and without the use of psychoactive plants. That has been the method that I have used to tune mind and body to stay on course with these very, very high-powered telluric frequencies that are in the Shakti cluster.
Very good. And would you recommend to people, though, that perhaps are in a different circumstance where they can't get out into nature or whatever, that they pursue some kind of a grounding practice, I guess you could say?
Absolutely. A grounding practice is very helpful because it takes a certain timbre or tonality of your mind-body to receive and hold these frequencies that are coming from the earth. We are instruments of her intelligence. And, you know, to use a very Aramaic or Archontic analogy, you know, we're like resistors and transistors on her circuit board. So if you want to tune your filaments, do it in whatever way works best for you. But I would advise, however, don't let the practice get in the way of the magic. The real magic comes whether you practice a body-mind discipline or not. And sometimes the problem with these body-mind disciplines, such as Qigong and things like that, I can think of certain people that I know, is that it becomes a cultic obsession. They are so wrapped up in these performances and in the intricacies of these acts and these exercises that it becomes, it leads to a state of self-absorption. And that is exactly the opposite of the state that you're going to be in when you're receptive to the telluric Dakini forces. It's not a state of self-absorption. It's a state of immersion. So I would say that body-mind disciplines are extremely healthy things to do, but don't let the practice get in the way of the magic of the interactivity.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. Yeah, don't let the practice itself become the predominant thing in your life. It's the tool you should be using, not the the theme, in a sense.
Yeah, I have a friend, someone I've known for quite a few years here in Europe, who practices Qigong very, very religiously, very rigorously. You know, never fails to do his sessions and to do the exercises. And I'm sure that he's advanced tremendously in that system. But but he doesn't do anything with it. It's just like a tool. And then you perfect the tool, but what do you use the tool for?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the point is that we already are in our body-mind system, in our nervous system, and in the iron streaming of the blood and the hemoglobin, we already are instruments in the electromagnetic field of the earth. We are instruments and filaments of her living intelligence. And interactivity is the key. No matter what skill you develop, you can be the most perfect Tai Chi master in the world and also be a total narcissist.
That's true.
Yeah. And narcissism is this, it's the lethal disease of the Piscean age. Narcissism is what makes us vulnerable to the Archonic virus. Narcissism is what is going to kill off a large part of our species. Don't worry about the eugenics program of the New World Order, folks. Narcissism is going to take out, and can potentially take out, a huge number of portion of the human race. Why? Because narcissism cuts you off from the vital and animating powers of the earth itself. And so the whole point of Gayan tantric practice is interactivity with those powers. And if you can pursue a body-mind discipline that enhances that, then all the better. But whatever you do, it had better enhance that. It had better enhance inactivity and immersion. Otherwise, it will just become a dead end.
Very good. I like that. That's wonderful. It becomes an ends to itself in a way, and that's not the right direction to go. Well, let me see. I had asked you a question in a mail here a few months ago, actually, that I would really like to hear you vocalize because I'd love your answer to it. What I had asked you is, what was Sophia doing with the Archons from the time of this, unforeseen mishap that created them, through to the time when she morphed into the planet body itself, and then much later when the with the arrival of the Anthropos, what was she doing with the Archons during these extremely long stretches of time?
Some really wicked things. Some really, really wicked things. according to the Sitna. Yeah. She was deeply occupied with them. And I would love to answer that question. I'd have to answer it at length, and I will be answering it at length in the upcoming talks, because we're going into a post-correction mode. To a large extent, Thomas, that is a question that can only be answered in post-correction.
Okay, good.
I would like people who've been following me on the Sophia myth to understand this as cogently and lucidly as possible, what I'm going to say now. The process of recovering and restoring the Sophia myth, which I did uniquely, and no other Gnostic scholar has done that or even attempted it, that process of restoration was, to a certain extent, a scholarly process. I went to the existing materials, which are pathetic and fragmentary and incoherent and a complete mishmash, and I dug the myth out of them and painstakingly reconstructed it. And, of course, I did so based on a range of my own mystical experiences and a range of the kind of things that an experimental mystic and a comparative mythologist understands. But nevertheless, it was largely a process of scholarly reconstruction, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Involving, of course, a high imaginative component. That's all pre-correction. Now, in post-correction, it's no longer a matter of reconstructing the myth. It's a matter of reliving it as she herself recalls the key episodes that she underwent. This is the enormous difference between our approach to the myth up until March 2011 and what is going to happen, what is now currently happening with great rapidity for the next 2 to 3 years. In the next 2 to 3 years, it will be possible to answer the question you just proposed at length. But it's only possible to understand some of the things that Sophia underwent in the remote past when we are in correction with her. And so this is really exciting because it means that the process of living with the myth moves out of its initial mode of a reconstruction, and it moves into another kind of mode of actually much more dynamic understanding of the myth. So we're right at that point right now. We're right at the pivot between those two approaches to the Sophianic vision story.
Mm-hmm.
I've been troubled, as you know, we've talked about this a number of times. I've been troubled over the last few years by the fact that the 9-episode version of the Sophia myth that I presented is not complete.
Yes.
Or the completion of the end of it. We know that the end of it is not complete because it's open-ended. It doesn't have a prescripted ending. I'm not talking
right.
about that. I'm talking about certain of the past episodes are missing or incompletely recounted.
Such as the creation of the moon.
The creation of the moon is missing. And also her interactions with the Archons over long, long periods of time are incompletely described.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really troubled about that because it's been a little over a year now, I think, that some people have volunteered, you being the first, to read the 9 episodes because I wanted to have it in an oral form as a recitation. And now you and several other people have volunteered to do this and have done it in a very beautiful way. Well, naturally, I was troubled by the thought that, well, should I have them read this 9-episode version or should I try to, top it up by filling in the episodes that are missing and the elements that are missing. I was contemplating that for quite a while. But the reality of it is that I can't do that because it cannot be the parts that are now going to be restored cannot merely be reconstructed in the way I did in the past. The parts that are now going to be restored, the parts of her story that we're now going to rediscover and learn, are the parts that she will recapitulate as she goes through correction. That's what I mean by following the recapitulation of the goddess in real time.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about that. I believe it was in the reading the captain's log number one. That I got chills up and down my whole physical body that when I read that. That just blew me away.
And I'm going to stay on that message because that is the whole message. That is the key focus of the message about what it means to be in correction. Now, to get back to your specific question, I'll just give you a preview, just give you a glimpse.
Okay.
In a way, I will say this, you know, as the Turton investigating this material, I have had some glimpses as to what these recapitulations of massive events in earthly cosmology will entail. You know, I have had some glimpses of that. And also there are some passages, fragmentary passages in the Gnostic cosmological myths, which actually allude to these things. But I left them out of the 9-episode version. The reason why I wrote the 9-episode version in the way that I did was so that it would be the elementary structure of the story that we can take on board first. And install, you know, it's like any other, to use again an archontic analogy, you install the 1.0 version of a program, and then later on you upgrade to the 2.0 or the 3.0. So the 9-episode version is the 1.0 version of the Sophia myth, and it's not wrong or inadequate simply because it's incomplete. It's just about all you can take on board for the first installation.
Sure, sure.
This is a massive, massively beautiful and complex myth. And every detail about it is crucially important to our understanding of our role and our place on Earth and in the cosmos. And you don't master any of it abstractly, ever. The only way you can master it is become a master of your own experience with the myth to guide you. That's how you master it. And there will be masters of the Sophia myth. And it's happening fast. You know, Sophia's action, Gaia's action, is vast and fast.
Vast and fast.
Vast and fast. That's how she works. So to give you a little glimpse, and I want to say that as having the privileged opportunity to see these things, I want to say that they're often very funny and they're also deeply shocking. For instance, when Sophia first realized that she had produced this unanticipated effect in the region of the galactic limbs, her splash, when she created this fracture zone, it was like, you know, a mess. The analogy is an aborted fetus. It's like, you know, the omelet on the kitchen floor, you know what I mean? Crude analogy, but it gives you some idea in a comical sense, a cosmic and comical sense, that she realized that she had this kind of mess on her hands. And so she attempted to clean it up, and she attempted to organize it first in this way. She saw that the Archons were a cyborg or locust-like inorganic species, which arose spontaneously out of the particulate matter of the galactic limb, as the Akari experiment shows. And she realized that they did not have any mind or intention of their own, but that they had to be occupied with something. Because there they were buzzing around like a hive of locusts. And so it wasn't such a big challenge for her as an Aeon, she thought, well, I'll tell you how I'll occupy them. I'll give them a playground to play in. You know? It's like you have a bunch of screaming kids on your hand who just got out of school, you know, and they're all running around and they have tons and tons of energy, but they don't have anything to do. So the teacher says, okay, go over here, and we're going to construct this playground together, sandboxes and slides and little merry-go-rounds, and then you can play on the playground. And then I can forget about you and go back to my lessons. See what I mean?
Yeah.
She actually, by investing them with her, a fragment of her own aeonic organizing intelligence, she allowed them to organize a world system, which for her purposes was just to get them out of her way, you know, to occupy them. And the amazing thing that is found in the cosmological text on the origin of the world, there's an amazing statement that it makes in there, which is that this was, let's call it, the first world of the Archons. It was the first Archontic heaven. And it was structured in a certain manner. If you would try to understand it in terms of what the solar system is today, it was structured somewhat concentrically, like the solar system is, but with Saturn at the center of it, not the sun. Because this was before the sun got involved.
Right.
So Saturn was at the center of this Archontic heaven, and it was kind of like a playground and a place where the Archons could live. They needed a habitat, and she can create habitats with a snap of her fingers. So they needed a habitat. They lived in this place. But because they invented it using a spark borrowed from her mind, it was a flimsy, flopsy creation, and it actually fell apart. And so what the origin of the world says is that the first Archontic heaven collapsed.
Huh.
Now, what does this mean? It suggests that in the remote cosmology of the solar system, we might put our minds back to a time when an early version of the solar system was formed, but it could not cohere, and it actually collapsed back into chaos. And then a second version of the solar system was created, which became the stable celestial mechanics that we understand today.
Now, that's with the introduction of the sun at that point?
That's right. The second system, things had also transpired in the cosmic order, which changed the conditions under which a solar system could arise. And so in the second system, Sophia had made this contract or pact with a solar body. And due to that connection, which still persists today, the structural, electromagnetic, and vital coupling of the Earth and the Sun. Due to that, Sophia could then allow the Archons to construct themselves a second heaven. And their second heaven was able to persist, was able to be a structurally viable world. And that is what we call today the solar system, exclusive of the Sun, Moon, and Earth. And it was that system, the second Archontic heaven, that the Earth became captured in.
That's fascinating. That's just amazing. And there's a couple follow-up things on that, John, but I'm going to shelve those because I want to, if it's all right with you, move on to the next series of things here.
Let's do that. But before you do, Thomas, so let me just add a footnote on here.
Sure.
I'm finding a remarkable synchronicity, and I strongly sense that those also who observe this cosmology with me, those of you who are learning this with me, we're learning this together, and we're learning how it works, and we're putting together the true story of planetary evolution. As you do so, as I do so now, I'm finding a remarkable synchronicity with so-called, quote, recent scientific discoveries, unquote. You know, It just seems that recent scientific discoveries, and I mean very recent, in the last few months, and also all of the new scientific modeling that's coming out of plasma cosmology, is converging with the Sophianic narrative in the most beautiful manner. And so one thing that I want to point out to people is to keep your mind open to science and to look for some scientific and astronomical correlates to the myth. For instance, I just got a link from someone yesterday that said that scientists have now observed that the solid material of which the Earth is composed, the rocky material, the geological mass of the Earth, does not appear to have been formed in the same way and in the same time as the material mass of the rest of the solar system.
Wow. Well, that fits perfectly in with what we've been talking about.
Absolutely fits. You know, like 2 years ago, Thomas, when I said to people, excuse me, folks, for being a Gnostic know-it-all smartass, but I'm here to tell you that the Earth doesn't belong to the solar system, but is only captured in it. I was really putting myself out on a limb by saying that, you know?
Sure. Yeah. I would guess at that time, nobody would lend an ear to that, huh?
It sounds extremely improbable, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds more and more probable as the days goes by. So I just want to point out, before we segue to the next topics, that I believe those of you who are following this myth and developing it with me will find that to be the case. More and more scientific discoveries and scientific breakthroughs confirming and correlating the sacred myth.
Very good. Wonderful. I love that. So keep that in mind. And let's go into a little bit more about the events that happened on March 19 and then shortly thereafter. You know, I believe it was last month, it might have been the month before, but looking at the sunset crescent, I realized that the angle of the crescent was almost horizontal. And I remember when that first hit my vision, I almost thought it fell down. It's like, this doesn't look right to me. All my memory of the sunset crescent from the childhood days is that it at a fairly good angle. So we're seeing these changes in the positions of stars and in kind of where the sun comes up, all kinds of things. So let's kind of talk about some of these things that have been coming up in the news in the past 3 or 4 months.
Oh, sure. It's really
a lot of them.
Really fantastic and really astounding, the things that are coming up. And I would point out that it's a most significant, to me, a most significant factor is the recurring use of the word anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the word anomaly is very, very key to the whole Gnostic cosmology. You find the actual root of the word anomaly in the Nag Hammadi writings, in the Greek loan words, because about one of every four words in Coptic is borrowed from Greek. So there's no Coptic word for anomaly. So the Coptic language uses the Greek word anomou, A-N-A-M-O-U. And this word, anomou, is essential to Gnostic cosmology, because the cosmology says that our solar system arose because of an anomou, because of an anomaly. We know now what that anomaly was.
Mm-hmm.
It was the fact that Sophia, in her plunge from the galactic core, produced an unanticipated impact and brought forth the Archon species. That is the big part of the anomaly. But on the other hand, by the same token, anomalies in the solar system are signs that we are correcting, that she is correcting that initial anomaly. It takes one anomaly to correct another.
Sure.
You know? So what are we seeing since correction, since March, and even sometime before? Everyone from 10-year-old kids who are standing there in the park looking at the moon with their children, to amateur sky observers, And to people like myself, who've been looking at the sky all their lives, people like you are saying, wait a minute, this looks strange.
Mm-hmm.
The moon looks at an odd angle. It seems to be spun around off its ordinary axis in a certain way. The other thing that many, many people have been remarking is that the sun is rising, appears to be rising much further toward the north than it ought to be.
Yes.
This has been observed by the Inuit Indians of Iceland and Greenland, and by many, many other people. You can find it in starting to appear now in YouTube clips and many boards and forums. People are posting questions like, what is going on? Why does the sun appear to be so far to the north? I initially observed this about 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when I was driving to Malaga Airport to get the airplane. You're driving up the coast, more or less due north, and I saw that the sun was right in front of me, and I thought, this is really weird. It should be off to my right, more, you know, the east. And then last summer, I observed it to an extent that was absolutely startling. So we're finding these anomalies happening. Why is this? Because the Earth, in correction, will actually write her own course, R-I-G-H-T. She will correct, and she will also write her own course, W-R-I-T-E.
Mm-hmm.
She will navigate according to her own proper animating powers, and she will no longer be, or appear to be, in the capture of the entire planetary system. Now, some people will say, well, this is impossible. It's impossible that the planet Earth could behave in any way that is not consistent with the laws of celestial mechanics. But I submit to you that the laws of celestial mechanics is just an archaic paradigm. And there is another paradigm of the living reality of this planet that is now beginning to replace and override that paradigm. And everyone who wants to go along for the ride and live into the new paradigm can live in Gaia's solution. And those who want to stay with the old paradigm and pretend that it's not happening can stay in that and see where it gets them. But it's irrefutable that these things are happening and that these anomalies are multiplying day by day. I'm sure you're following them, you know, quite close.
Oh, indeed. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, there's talk about the current pole star Polaris being out of position by a few degrees. You know, we had the past few months, birds dying all over the place, fishes dying all over the place. I myself, it was last summer here in Japan, there was a lightning storm that went on here for 2 hours, where the whole sky, and I'm not making this up, the whole sky was lit up, the whole sky, for 2 hours, you know, boom, 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 sometimes with sound, sometimes without sound. It was the most amazing display of whatever it was, light or plasma or whatever I've ever seen. It was like being in broad daylight at, you know, at 10 o'clock at night. Just amazing things happening.
Yeah, and they're continuing to happen and to multiply every day. And, of course, one of the, let's talk about deviance for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that in order to follow these anomalies and to see what is actually happening to the Earth in the macrocosmic scale, two things are required. First of all, you've just got to observe, got to use your first attention, as sorcerers call it. Just go out and observe nature. Don't be a casual observer. Be a devoted observer. Be a vigilant observer. Observer. For instance, when we look at the moon each month, when we wait for the crescent moon in order to follow the Dakini cycles, we're being vigilant observers. So go out and really look at the sky, really look at nature, really look at the lightning storm. And then combine that observation of the first attention with your imagination, which is the second attention. And bring your imagination to the observation of these events. In order to help people do that, I'm proposing to use this nautical analogy. I'll give you an example of exactly how to combine these two factors, observation and imagination, using the nautical analogy. One of the anomalies that's been reported quite recently is these vast cracks that are appearing in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about them?
Indeed.
Yeah. Some of them are like two miles long.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are shorter, but they're appearing in various places in the world. Now, this is something that we observe. Nobody's making this up. This is a physical reality. If you are in those locales, you can actually go out and look at these cracks. What I'm suggesting is that we use a nautical analogy, that is to say, an imaginative exercise, in order to understand what we're seeing. So I would say this: why are we seeing these cracks in the earth? Seeing these cracks because the mothership, the planet Earth, is turning in the galactic stream out of the currents that have entrained her, out of the currents that are directed by the planetary system, and she's turning and pulling the mothership around into her own proper course of navigation. Now, as she does that, she behaves like any ship will do. If you're on an America's sailing yacht and you're racing along on one of those beautiful vessels and you have to bring the yacht around in a turn, the boom, you know, sweeps over the boat, the sail moves to the other side of the boat, and suddenly the hull is driven hard into the heaving waves as the boat heaves around and takes a new tack. And this is exactly what the planet Earth is doing. And as a result of that, we're going to see that there is a great deal of groaning, a great deal of tectonic stress, and even cracks opening, as cracks might open in the hull of a ship. It doesn't mean that she's going to sink, you know. Ships are designed so that they can have a certain flexibility in the hull. If the hull were rigid, it wouldn't be able, it would do worse than if it were somewhat flexible. Another factor of the newly emerging paradigm of science that's very helpful for this purpose is the expanding Earth. We are told now by certain people that the Earth was much smaller when it was originally created, and that it expanded and grew to be a much
mm-hmm.
globe, you know? So the concept of the expanding Earth plays along very well with this nautical metaphor, that the mothership can actually expand, that the hull will actually be expanding and responding to the currents that she's moving into. And all of this is part of a way to visualize what is actually happening to us, to visualize it with the imagination at the same time that we observe it. And this nautical analogy can be carried very, very, very far, as will be seen soon, I think.
Yeah, that analogy, you actually pointed out in one of the audio files that you made that it's really not even an analogy. It's kind of just a description of, you know, really what's going on. It goes beyond being a metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, what's the difference between calling the Earth a planet and calling it a celestial boat? I mean, what's the difference, you know?
Yeah.
What's a planet? Well, a planet is a celestial boat.
Yeah. It sure is, and if it's a living being, you know, living beings grow and change, you know.
They do, and living beings, you know, are also capable of self-propulsion. No, I got an email from a longtime follower of the site who said to me, "Gee, John, I read the first post-correction entry, and you're saying that now we're going to actually witness how the Earth operates as a self-propelling craft. And how can that be if the Earth is captured in the gravitational vortices of the solar system and so forth, you know?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, first of all, the capture of the Earth in the gravitational vortices of the solar system is just an archonic paradigm. It's just a model, and it's not a very good one, even at that. And it has a lot of faults and flaws in it. But secondly, if the Earth is a living entity, then it can propel itself. How do fish swim? How do birds fly? You know? When you look at birds flying, it's totally amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just flap their wings and sort of glide along. They actually propel themselves. Where do they get that propulsion from?
Indeed.
How is it possible? Do you know that the peregrine falcon has been clocked as flying at 240 miles an hour?
Wow. That's faster than a falling object, yeah.
Faster than a falling object. A peregrine falcon on a dive, can clock 240 miles an hour. You explain that. And that's just a tiny little bird, you know. Now, the Earth is moving right now at 18 miles a second. So every time you snap your fingers, the Earth has moved 18 miles. And there's so much that we don't know about how that motion actually happens. But with correction, all of this comes within the range of human experience, and it becomes possible for us to be conscious passengers on this celestial boat, and even to be part of the navigational crew, which is what we're going to talk about a lot in our upcoming sessions, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, John, there's still so much to talk about just on this one subject that we'll kind of squeeze these in and out here as we get into our later talks. So let's kind of trim that off there, because there's a question here I want to ask before we start to round things up. And that is, with this call being made to the crew, in a sense, on March 19, the question that then comes up, you know, what is the role of, you know, the main Turton in this? And then what is the role of the Argonauts, or of the crew that are on board here? What are the two roles there that are going to be involved here in the next phase?
Sure. Well, I'd like to cover that as cogently as I can. Before I address that, though, just let me reiterate,
mm-hmm.
you know, March 19th. Imagine that you are on a big ocean liner and that you are members of the crew, that not are members of the crew that work in the kitchen, not members of the crew that do the cabin service, not members of the crew that take care of the entertainment of this Carnival cruise vessel that we're on, but actually members who work with the captain on the bridge and are involved in the navigation. But imagine that you members of the navigational team are kind of mingling with the passengers. So you're all over the boat, you're at different floors of it, or you may be lounging around at the pool and having a tequila sunrise. You can see the deck of the bridge of the ocean liner. The bridge, of course, is where the helm is. It's the wheelhouse. And you can see it. It's always up there. It's the highest level of any ocean liner or any big vessel, cargo vessel, isn't it? So you can look up at the bridge. And at a certain moment, a sound comes from the bridge. That's because there is a bullhorn fastened to the outside of the wheelhouse. Generally in these big Carnival ships and these big passenger liners, there are two bullhorns attached to either side of the wheelhouse. And suddenly a blast comes out from these bullhorns. What is the meaning of that blast? It's a signal to those of the crew of the navigational team who are here and there on the vessel to come together and join the captain in the wheelhouse, because major decisions have to be made in plotting the course of the ship, and the captain needs the navigational team to stand around the table where the nautical charts are laid out. They need to get out the astrolabe. They need to look at the stars, and they need to consult as a team with the captain on the coordinates of the journey. So what happened on March 19th was that a signal actually went out from the center, from the interior of the Earth. That was due to the barycenter of the Earth, which is the common center of mass between the Earth and the Moon, exceeding the speed of gravity as it tunnels around the Earth. And people actually heard this sound at that time, and there were remarkable reports of mysterious rumbling and kind of droning that came from the inside of the Earth, including from a cave in Tibet. And so that signal was the moment when Gaia, the planet, signaled to some of us human beings who want to be on her navigational team. It was at that moment, March 19th, that she called our attention to the fact that she is making her correction. At the same time that she did that, this planet, the living embodiment of the Sophia, reestablished communication with the Pleromic Center by sending them a set of coordinates so that they would be able to now signal back and forth with her and follow her journey, follow her navigation through the galactic arms in a way that they haven't been able to do before. So the signal that was released on March 19th was of two kinds. One was the signals that she sent to the Pleromic Core, and we don't know, I haven't tried to describe yet, how those signals operate or how we can actually detect what they are, but I'm in the process of working that out. And then there was the signal that she sent on board to the navigational team. And from that point on, that team defines itself. It's an elective process. If you want to be on the bridge in the wheelhouse with Gaia Sophia, that's a choice you make. It's an elective process that can be, that now can be realized by everyone who heard that signal.
Now, what is your role in this as the main Turton here?
There are two roles, basically. Mm-hmm. My role as the Turton is to continue to outline her story, to present the general outlines of her story. Because the general outlines of her story, of the Sophia myth, represent the journey in a way. The journey is a metaphor that serves two applications for us. First of all, the journey is an astronomical journey. We are on a journey through the third galactic limb, the third galactic arm of a massive spiral galaxy. The sun, the moon, the earth, and the planets are like a fleet of ships taking a journey up that great stream called the galactic arm. That is the actual physical cosmological journey. But the metaphor of the journey also provides another meaning. We are on a journey in divine memory. Mm-hmm. And in the memory of the goddess, she recalls her own story. The unique role, people would ask, well, what is the unique role of human beings on Earth that distinguishes us from other animals? That role is that we are a memory circuit in the Gaian ecosystem. We are not her memory, because she has her own memory, as any animal does. She has her own memory as a planet and as an aeon. But we are a crucial circuit in that memory system. And because we are a circuit, we have an interface to her recall process. Now, as Gaia undergoes correction, not only will her physical and astronomical position in the solar system change, physically change right in front of our eyes. But she will also, moment by moment, recall the great episodes in her own story. And so our journey, in another sense, is to live through the recall with her. And my role as a Turton is to present the general lines and show how to do that. But the role of the navigational team is to bring their imaginations to that event.
Bring their imaginations to it. And I would recommend people to print out the rim site drawings that you have made and, you know, keep one in your car, keep one in your, wherever you do your observations. I put mine out onto a nice little cardboard background there, and I've got three or four of them made up, so I've always got one on hand. And start interacting with things, start studying up and getting familiar with the night sky.
One of the requirements of being on the navigational team is that you, at the very least, recognize the 12 constellations, the 13 constellations of the zodiac. You would be able to recognize them by observing them at night, and you would be able to recognize them on a circular map. So yeah, the rim site map is the main navigational tool. And I'll be presenting many versions and details of these 13 constellations and showing how the real-time activity in those constellations tells us what she's remembering and tells us how she's adjusting the course she takes through the galaxy. This is actually can be known by human beings with our minds. With our minds, you know, to be on the bridge means to be in the bridge. And where is the bridge? The bridge is the bridge between human cerebration and her divine animation. And if you want to know the most wonderful truth in the world, as far as I'm concerned, then this is it. That our minute, microcosmic cerebration of our minds is bridged to her mind. And that's why interactivity is not only possible, it is happening all the time.
Yeah, it's not only possible. I thought you were going to say that it's essential. Yeah, that's, we are an essential factor in this divine experiment.
That's right. So when I say interactive magic with Gaia, I'm not talking about Harry Potter kind of, you know? I'm talking about a huge responsibility, but also a tremendous adventure. And it's a lot of fun to do this. It really is fun. Learning the basic astronomy is not that hard. And it really is fun, because then you are really connecting with the cosmos. This is not abstraction, folks. This is real-time interactivity, your mind bridged to the mind of the planet.
Indeed, this is where it really begins. We've, in a sense, been preparing things just for this. And in these future talks, that's where we're going to be going. And I would recommend people to get up to speed with things because, you know, John, you've been going like a madman here with these post-correction writings. It's very hard to keep up with you in the past month. It's just amazing. And you have a couple of audio files up as well. So please, people, get up to speed here.
Right. I'm putting up these audio files. In fact, and I highlighted on the site, and this is quite important, Thomas, that post-correction writings will always be indicated by the title in capital letters.
Mm-hmm.
You can always go back and read previous material on metahistory and, of course, learn about the goddess scenario and learn about the Dakinis as much as you like. But to keep current, read the post-correction material as it comes out. And it's going to come out rapidly because, as I said, her action is vast and fast. And in her time, correction takes 10 seconds. 10 seconds. Of course, 1 second is, you know, to her is much greater than it is to us, you know?
Sure.
It takes 10 seconds. 1 second is 108 days of our time. 10 seconds is 1,080 days, which is about 3 years. So this process of correction, which began in March 2011, will complete itself around March 2014. And my role as the Turton, and you could say so far the navigator who has, you know, I just happen to have so far the most experience with this particular kind of navigation, is to lay out the outlines of the journey, and then everyone gets on the journey in the way that their life and their imagination suits that journey.
Very good. Very good. And go ahead, and people get, when you have a chance, look at for a glimpse of things to come, look at the Bodhisattva constellation, Humanity Snatched from the Jaws of Dagon, which is the most current writing up on Planetary Tantra. And John, we both run on GarageBand, so we're about at the end of our recording limits. So to end things here today, John, I would like you to go ahead and propose a title for these post-correction talks so we can kind of make a dividing line here. How should we title this?
Yeah. Well, that's... I think that reading the captain's log or navigating with the wisdom goddess would be the most appropriate titles for the material coming ahead.
Okay. That's good. Let's say navigating navigating with the wisdom goddess in the post-correction shift or something like that. Very good. Okay, John. Well, I still have a lot of questions here, but I'll work these out into the next phase of things. And let's go ahead and call it a day for now. And we'll get into the next phase here in a couple days.
Excellent.
Very good. And your voice held out just fine, so that's good news.
And thanks ever so much for your unfailing efforts, Thomas. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for your initiative to start all this. So I'm grateful and really excited about going into the second phase of these talks.
Well, thank you. It's an absolute pleasure, and it's been nothing but a joy so far, and I think it's going to be even more of an adventure here on out. So with that, let's go ahead and round things up, and I look forward to talking to you in a few days. Thank you.